Attention listeners, join us at the Shine Music Fest on Saturday, August 24th. Look forward to lots of fun and interactive experiences, including a live recording of the Blind Chick podcast. Learn more and RSVP at www.shinemusicfest.com/event-info.
Welcome. You are listening to AfterSight. This recording is intended solely for individuals who are blind or have low vision.
Thank you for joining us for the Denver Post, read by Diane Adler. This is being recorded on Tuesday, July 2nd, 2024. Today, we will be reading the following main articles. Presidential Power. Supreme Court declares former presidents have broad immunity. Decision dims chance of Trump trial before November election. Gaza. Israel instructs residents to flee. Orders signaling likely new assault on Khan Yunis. Family program. Colorado workers receive over $311 million in paid leave. Over 62,000 workers have received partial compensation in 2024. And following up with miscellaneous articles. Presidential power. Supreme Court declares former presidents have broad immunity. Decision dims chance of Trump trial before November election. By Mark Sherman, The Associated Press, Washington. The Supreme Court on Monday ruled for the first time that former presidents have broad immunity from prosecution, extending the delay in the Washington criminal case against Donald Trump on charges he plotted to overturn his 2020 presidential election loss and all but ending prospects the former president could be tried before the November election. In a historic 6-3 ruling, the court's conservative majority, including the three justices appointed by Trump, narrowed the case against him and returned it to the trial court to determine what is left of Special Counsel Jack Smith's indictment. Trump celebrated, quote, a big win, end quote, on X. President Joe Biden said the justices set, quote, a dangerous precedent that undermines the rule of this nation, end quote. The ruling reflected a muscular view of presidential power and left dissenting judges to criticize it as undermining a core democratic principle that no person is above the law. The court's decision highlighted how the justices have been thrust into an impactful role in the November presidential election. Earlier, they had rejected efforts to bar him from the ballot because of his actions following the 2020 election. The court last week also limited an obstruction charge faced by Trump and used against hundreds of his supporters who stormed the Capitol on January 6, 2021. The split among the justices also in many ways mirrored the political divide in the country. Quote, under our constitutional structure of separated powers, the nature of presidential power entitles a former president to absolute immunity from criminal prosecution for actions within his conclusive and preclusive constitutional authority, end quote, Chief Justice John Roberts wrote for the court. Quote, and he is entitled to at least presumptive immunity from prosecution for all his official acts. There is no immunity for unofficial acts, end quote. The Chief Justice insisted that the president, quote, is not above the law, end quote. But in a fiery dissent for the court's three liberals, Justice Sonia Sotomayor wrote, quote, in every use of official power, the president is now a king above the law, end quote. Reading from her opinion in the courtroom, Sotomayor said, quote, because our Constitution does not shield a former president from answering for criminal and treasonous acts, I dissent, end quote. Sotomayor said the decision, quote, makes a mockery of the principle foundational to our Constitution and system of government that no man is above the law, end quote. The protection afforded presidents by the court, she said, quote, is just as bad as it sounds, and it is baseless, end quote. Trump posted in all capital letters on his social media network shortly after the decision was released, quote, big win for our Constitution and democracy. Proud to be an American, end quote. Biden, in evening remarks from the White House, cited accepted restraints on presidential power all the way back to George Washington and bemoaned that, quote, "For all practical purposes, today's decision almost certainly means that there are virtually no limits on what a president can do," end quote. Smith's office declined to comment on the ruling. Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer denounced the ruling as, quote, "a disgraceful decision," end quote, made with the help of the three justices that Trump appointed. Quote, "It undermines SCOTUS's credibility and suggests political influence trumps all in our courts today," end quote, the New York Democrat said on X. The justices knocked out one aspect of the indictment. The opinion found Trump is, quote, "absolutely immune," unquote, from prosecution for alleged conduct involving discussions with the Justice Department. Trump is also, quote, "at least presumptively immune," end quote, from allegations that he tried to pressure Vice President Mike Pence to reject certification of Democrat Joe Biden's electoral vote win on January 6, 2021. Prosecutors can try to make the case that Trump's pressure on Pence still can be part of the case against him, Roberts wrote. The court directed a fact-finding analysis on one of the more striking allegations in the indictment, that Trump participated in a scheme to enlist fake electors in battleground states won by Biden who would falsely assert that Trump had won. Both sides had dramatically different interpretations as to whether that effort could be construed as official, and the conservative justices said determining which side is correct would require additional analysis at the trial court level. Roberts' opinion further restricted prosecutors by prohibiting them from using any official acts as evidence in trying to prove a president's unofficial actions violated the law. One example not relevant to this case, but which came up in arguments, was the hypothetical payment of a bribe in return for an ambassadorial appointment. Under Monday's decision, a former president could be prosecuted for accepting a bribe, but prosecutors could not mention the official act, the appointment, in their case. Justice Amy Coney Barrett, who joined the rest of Roberts' opinion, parted company on this point. Quote, "The Constitution does not require blinding juries to the circumstances surrounding conduct for which presidents can be held liable," end quote, Barrett wrote. She also described as unnecessary the analysis of the fake electors claim. Quote, "I see no plausible argument for barring prosecution of that alleged conduct," end quote, Barrett wrote. The work of figuring out how to proceed will fall to U.S. District Judge Chanya Chutkan, who would preside over Trump's trial. Trump still could face a trial, said Notre Dame law professor Derek Mueller. Quote, "But the fact remains that it is almost impossible to happen before the election," end quote. David Becker, an election law expert and the executive director of the nonprofit Center for Election Innovation and Research, called the breadth of immunity granted to Trump, quote, "incredibly broad," end quote, and, quote, "deeply disturbing," end quote. Quote, "Almost anything that a president does with the executive branch is characterized as an official act," end quote, he said on a call with reporters following the ruling. He said that, quote, "for any unscrupulous individual holding the seat of the Oval Office who might lose an election, the way I read this opinion is that it could be a roadmap for them seeking to stay in power," end quote. The ruling was the last of the term, and it came more than 2 months after the court heard arguments, far slower than in other epic high court cases involving the presidency, including the Watergate tapes case. In May, Trump became the first former president to be convicted of a felony in a New York court. He was found guilty of falsifying business records to cover up a hush money payment made during the 2016 presidential election to a porn actor who says she had sex with him, which he denies. After Monday's ruling, Trump's lawyers asked the New York judge who presided over that trial to set aside his conviction and delay his sentencing. He still faces three other indictments. The Republican former president has denied doing anything wrong and has said this prosecution and three others are politically motivated to try to keep him from returning to the White House. Smith is leading the two federal inquiries of the former president, both of which have led to criminal charges. The Washington case focuses on Trump's alleged efforts to overturn the 2020 election after he lost to Biden. The case in Florida revolves around the mishandling of classified documents. A separate case in Georgia also turns on Trump's actions after his defeat in 2020. If Trump's Washington trial does not take place before the 2024 election and he is not given another 4 years in the White House, he presumably would stand trial soon thereafter. But if he wins, he could appoint an attorney general who would seek the dismissal of this case and the other federal prosecution he faces. He could also attempt to pardon himself if he reclaims the White House. He could not pardon himself for the conviction in state court in New York. The Supreme Court that heard the case included three justices appointed by Trump. Gaza. Israel instructs residents to flee, orders signaling likely new assault on Khan Yunis. But Mohammed Jajo, Sami Magdi, and Julia Frankel, The Associated Press, Khan Yunis, Gaza Strip. The Israeli army ordered a mass evacuation of Palestinians from much of Khan Yunis on Monday, a sign that troops are likely to launch a new ground assault into the Gaza Strip's second-largest city. The order suggests Khan Yunis will be the latest target of Israel's raids into parts of Gaza it had previously invaded in the war, as it pursues regrouping Hamas. Much of Khan Yunis was destroyed in a long assault earlier this year, but large numbers of Palestinians had moved back to escape another Israeli offensive in Gaza's southernmost city, Rafah. The evacuation came as Israel released the director of what was once Gaza's largest hospital after holding him for 7 months without charge or trial. Israel alleged the hospital had been used as a Hamas command center, which he and other Palestinian health officials have denied. The doctor said he and other detainees were held under harsh conditions and tortured. The decision to release Mohammed Abu Salmia raised questions over Israel's claims surrounding Shifa Hospital, which Israeli forces have raided twice since the start of the war with Hamas. The hospital was left severely damaged after the raids. Abu Salmia's release triggered an uproar across Israel's political spectrum. Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu's office called it a, quote, grave mistake, end quote. Government ministers and opposition leaders expressed outrage and insisted Abu Salmia played a role in Hamas's alleged use of the hospital, although Israeli security services rarely unilaterally free prisoners if they have a suspicion of militant links. Monday's evacuation order covered the eastern half of Khan Yunis and a large swath of the Gaza Strip's southeast corner. Earlier in the day, the army said a barrage of rockets out of Gaza was fired from Khan Yunis. As night fell, streams of civilians trudged on foot beside a steady flow of vehicles as people began making their way out of the evacuation zone. A woman dragged a rolling suitcase with a little girl riding on top. Others carried a few critical belongings, mattresses, clothing, plastic buckets for washing, an electric fan. Trucks were piled high with possessions and furniture. Quote, we received a message on our mobile phones, end quote, to evacuate, said one displaced woman, Zainab Abu Jazer, holding back tears. Quote, look at these children, how they walk. We did not find a car to ride in, end quote. Israel told people to move to Muwasi, a coastal area designated by the Israeli army as a safe zone and which has become filled with crowded and unsanitary tent camps. The order suggested a new assault into Khan Yunis was imminent. Israeli forces fought for weeks in Khan Yunis earlier this year and withdrew, claiming to have destroyed Hamas battalions. But in other places where the military has made similar claims, renewed raids have underscored Hamas's capabilities. Last week, the military ordered an evacuation from the North Gaza district of Shayjaya, and intensive fighting has followed. Netanyahu said Monday that the military was, quote, making progress toward ending the phase of the destruction of Hamas's terror army, end quote. But he said forces will continue to, quote, target their remains going forward, end quote. More fighting in the Khan Yunis area could further hamper Palestinians' access to much-needed potable water. Included in the evacuation zone is a water line that Israel installed following criticism over its cutoff of water to the Strip earlier in the war. Also in the zone is the area surrounding the Kerem Shalom crossing, the major aid crossing to southern Gaza, and an aid route inside the territory that Israel has said it would safeguard. Most of Gaza's population of 2.3 million have fled their homes, with many displaced multiple times. Israeli restrictions, fighting, and the breakdown of public order have hindered the delivery of humanitarian aid, fueling widespread hunger and sparking fears of famine. U.S. Secretary General Antonio Guterres said the new evacuation order, quote, just shows yet again that no place is safe in Gaza, end quote, for Palestinian civilians. Quote, it's another stop in this deadly circular movement that the population in Gaza has to undergo on a regular basis, end quote, he said in a statement calling for a ceasefire. The decision to release Abu Selmia and 54 other Palestinian detainees back into Gaza appeared to be meant to free up space in overcrowded detention centers. Since the start of the war, Israeli forces have detained thousands of Palestinians from Gaza and the occupied West Bank. Many are being held without charge or trial in what is known as administrative detention. Quote, our detainees have been subjected to all kinds of torture behind bars, end quote, Abu Selmia told a news conference. Quote, there was almost daily torture, end quote. He said guards used batons to beat detainees and terrorize them with dogs. He said some detainees had limbs amputated because of poor medical care. He said a beating caused his head to bleed and guards broke his finger. The allegations could not be independently confirmed, but matched other accounts of Palestinians who have been held in Israeli custody. There was no immediate response from the prison service, which has denied similar accusations. Israeli forces raided Shifa Hospital in November, alleging that Hamas had created an elaborate command and control center inside. Abu Selmia and other staff denied the allegations and accused Israel of recklessly endangering thousands of patients and displaced people sheltering there. Abu Selmia was detained on November 22nd. After its first raid on Shifa Hospital, the military uncovered a tunnel beneath it leading to two empty rooms, as well as evidence that Hamas had brought wounded hostages to the facility. But the evidence fell short of showing an extensive base as claimed. Israel has since raided other Gaza hospitals on similar allegations, forcing them to shut down or drastically reduce services. Amid the uproar over Abu Selmia's release, the various Israeli state organs responsible for detentions scrambled to shift blame. Netanyahu's office said Abu Selmia, quote, belongs in prison, end quote, and that the prime minister had ordered a thorough review into how the release happened. It said the decision was made, quote, without the knowledge of the political echelon or the heads of the organizations, end quote. Family program. Colorado workers receive over $311 million in paid leave. Over 62,000 workers have received partial compensation in 2024. By Seth Klammen, The Denver Post. Colorado's new statewide paid leave program doled out more than $311 million in compensation to tens of thousands of workers in its first 6 months, the State Department of Labor and Employment said Monday. More than 62,000 workers have had their pay partially replaced under the Family and Medical Leave Insurance, or FAMLI, program. The program seeks to compensate people who have to leave work for a covered personal issue, including to care for a new baby or to deal with a serious health condition. The average payment from the program was just more than $915, according to data released by the state. Quote, I couldn't be prouder of the work we've done to bring Colorado workers the benefits they voted for, end quote, Tracy Marshall, Family's director, said in a statement Monday. Quote, we're on solid financial footing for the future, thanks to all the Colorado employers and workers who stepped up to build this insurance fund a year and a half ago, end quote. The portal to file claims opened in November, though the program didn't start paying money until this year. The program is funded partially by premiums split between employers and employees, totaling 0.9% of the employee's wages, and the money for approved claims is paid out by the state. Payments from the program are calculated using a sliding scale that's based on a worker's recent average weekly wage. The program was created in 2020 after Colorado voters approved Proposition 118. Eligible workers include those who take time off after having or adopting a child to care for their own serious medical condition or for that of a family member, to make arrangements for a military deployment, or to address impacts or safety needs from a sexual assault or domestic violence incident. Most workers can receive compensation for up to 12 weeks, although the timeline extends to 16 weeks for birth or pregnancy complications. In January, Marshall said the program expected to receive more than 67,000 claims by June 30th, which is the end of the state's fiscal year. More than 38,000 of the claims filed thus far were for a person's own medical condition. Nearly 33,000 were to bond with a new child, according to the new data. The average continuous leave taken under the program is more than 53 days, according to the Labor Department. More than 44,000 workers have completed their leave and already returned to work. Workers who live in the Greeley area, Aurora, Parker, Lone Tree, Commerce City, and Northeast Denver submitted the most claims, according to zip code level data provided by the department. COVID-19. State seeing summer increase in infections. Virus concentrations are up in Colorado's wastewater systems. By Meg Wingerter, The Denver Post. Colorado, along with much of the country, is experiencing a summer bump in COVID-19 infections, showing the virus has yet to fall into a seasonal pattern. Flu, respiratory syncytial virus, and other common respiratory bugs typically start spreading in the fall and peter out by spring. In Colorado, the worst points of the pandemic fell in the fall and winter, but COVID-19 hasn't disappeared in the warmer months, as flu does. 4 years ago, at the beginning of the pandemic, scientists expected the virus would be well on its way to settling into a seasonal pattern by now, said Talia Quandalesi, an assistant professor of epidemiology at the Colorado School of Public Health. Now, they're less sure whether COVID-19 will eventually do that, or if it can keep churning out new variants fast enough to remain active year-round, she said. Quote, "That's one of the big questions in the field," end quote, she said. Colorado's most recent weekly wastewater data showed concentrations of the virus increasing in three-quarters of the 55 utilities statewide that supplied information. The state's wastewater data doesn't indicate how widespread a virus is, but it can show whether that particular infection is becoming more or less common. The number of Colorado watersheds showing an increasing pattern has gradually risen since early May, when none were. The number of new COVID-19 cases reported to the state also has trended upward since mid-May, although since relatively few people get tested in facilities that report results, the figure isn't a reliable indicator of how many Coloradans actually got sick. Nationwide, the percentage of tests coming back positive, emergency department visits for the virus, and COVID-19 deaths all have risen in recent weeks, Quandalesi said. Hospitalizations ticked up nationwide, rising about 36% from their low point in May, before flattening in early June. They remain low, however, with about 1.5 COVID-19 hospitalizations for every 100,000 people, compared to a rate of 7.7 per 100,000 people last winter. The Centers for Disease Control and Prevention no longer requires all hospitals to disclose how many COVID-19 patients they're treating, and only about one-third do voluntarily, making the number of patients significantly fuzzier than it was earlier in the pandemic. Data on the percentage of tests coming back positive, prevalence in wastewater and emergency room visits also indicate whether the virus is becoming more or less common, but don't allow for exact comparisons to previous years. Unlike in some previous waves, this one isn't the result of one variant gaining dominance, Quandalese said. Rather, KP.3, KP.2, and LB.1 combined to have dethroned JN.1, which dominated during the winter and early spring. All are descendants of Omicron and appear to be about equally likely to cause severe illness. Some epidemiologists group the three together under the term, quote, flirt, end quote, variants, based on a shortening of the technical terms for their mutations. Quote, I think it does have to do with these new variants, end quote, she said. Quote, having all of these circulating together means we're more likely to have infections, end quote. In Colorado, rates of COVID-19 remain low, with 87 people hospitalized with the virus statewide as of Tuesday, although infections have increased slightly in recent weeks, said Kayla Glad, a spokeswoman for the Colorado Department of Public Health and Environment. At the low point at the end of April, 75 people were in Colorado hospitals for the virus. The shifting variants could be a factor, but other possibilities include summer travel, people spending more time indoors as the weather heats up, and waning immunity, she said. Also, most people haven't had a COVID-19 vaccine in a year or longer, Quandalese said. While protection against severe illness lasts longer, immunity to infection starts to wane within months. People who didn't get boosters in the fall or winter should consider one now, particularly if they are at higher risk of severe illness, Quandalese said. The Centers for Disease Control and Prevention recommended that everyone 6 months or older get the latest COVID-19 shot when it becomes available, but that won't be for at least another 3 months, she said. Quote, I think it's still a good call to get the booster if it's been a while, end quote, she said. Wearing masks in indoor public places also will reduce the risk of getting the virus, Quandalese said. People who feel like they might have the flu or a cold should test for COVID-19, and if they have it, they should stay home until their symptoms resolve, she said. While most people no longer treat COVID-19 as a threat, the virus hospitalized about 916,000 people and killed about 76,000 in 2023, including 626 people in Colorado. While the odds of developing long COVID seem to have fallen over time, the debilitating chronic symptoms that can follow a routine infection remain a risk, Quandalese said. Quote, it's still an infection that has longer-term consequences that we want to prevent, end quote, she said. Transit. RTD turns to voters for financial assistance. Ballot measure will ask voters to exempt agency from Tabor, by Bruce Finley, The Denver Post. RTD directors will ask voters for financial help through a ballot measure November 5th that will allow the agency to keep the tax revenue it collects instead of providing refunds required under Colorado's Taxpayer Bill of Rights. A ballot measure unanimously approved by the directors last week would continue RTD's current exemption from Tabor requirements permanently. That exemption otherwise would expire in November. More than $600 million in tax revenues that RTD has collected will be subject to Tabor requirements in 2025, according to Eric Davidson, who chairs the board of directors. The ballot measure voters will face distinguishes between imposing a new tax and being allowed to keep tax revenues RTD already collects through existing taxes. During the public comment period, during RTD directors' meeting last week, former board member Natalie Menton challenged that distinction. Letting RTD keep unspent tax revenues instead of refunding them, as the Tabor law requires, quote, is a tax increase, end quote, Menton argued. RTD board members commissioned a political consultant to conduct a poll to test the wording, determining that 68% of voters in the Colorado Front Range areas served by RTD Transit would approve it. Quote, asking the voters to permit RTD to retain the revenues it collects from sales and use tax is important to ensure RTD can sustainably operate and maintain the transit system the voters invested in, end quote, Davidson told the Denver Post. A coalition of pro-transit advocacy groups and the Caucus of Mayors from 38 Colorado cities have backed the campaign. The groups include the Denver Streets Partnership, Green Latinos, ARP Colorado, and the Southwest Energy Efficiency Project. If voters do not approve the measure, RTD would no longer keep revenues of around $100 million to $200 million a year, which likely would compel cutting about 20% of bus and train service within 2 years, Greater Denver Transit co-founder Richard Bamber said. Quote, there are many valid comments out there regarding the frequency and reliability of RTD services. Not approving the continuing Tabor cap exemption would only make the service issues worse, not better, end quote, Bamber said. Quote, while we absolutely need to keep the pressure on RTD's management to perform, we need to keep investing in public transit if we are to provide a transportation system that works for all and achieves our goals relating to safety, congestion, and reduction of aid emissions, end quote. Colorado voters in 1992 approved Tabor as an amendment of the state's constitution. It requires voter approval for tax hikes and limits the amount of revenue government agencies can keep. In 1995, voters granted RTD an exemption that lasted through 2005. In 1999, voters granted an exemption through November 2024 to help RTD pay off bond debts incurred to finance the construction of RTD light rail expansion. In brief, Oak Ridge fire sparked on June 22nd is 5% contained. The lightning-sparked Oak Ridge fire, now burning on 1,190 acres of U.S. Forest Service land in Pueblo County, is 5% contained as of Monday morning. Fire officials, in a Monday morning update, said the containment line is likely to hold west of Beulah, but the containment percentage may decrease during strategic fire operations. Sparked by lightning on June 22nd, the fire, burning in the Pike San Isabel National Forest, has spread relatively slowly over the past week, but was 0% contained until Monday morning. On Saturday, the fire was burning on 1,156 acres of land, an increase by 34 acres, about 26 football fields, by Monday. The fire's estimated containment date is July 24th, fire officials said. Rain on Saturday night allowed fire officials to expand a fire line made of unburned fuel, helping control the wildfire's spread, officials said in a Sunday update. On Monday, firefighters focused on fire prevention for cabins in Fairview Meadows. The fire is the first to burn in the area in more than 100 years, forest officials said. This brief was from Juliana O'Claire, the Denver Post. Sheriff's Office to once again allow cowboy hats. After a decades-long ban on the uniform edition, Arapahoe County Sheriff's deputies will once again be allowed to don cowboy hats on patrol. The last time Arapahoe County deputies were allowed to wear cowboy hats was in the early 1980s, according to a social media post from the Sheriff's Office. Cowboy hats are an optional addition to the uniform, and deputies have to buy their own, the Sheriff's Office said. The hat is a black wool Stetson from the Stallion Collection. Arapahoe County Sheriff Tyler Brown recently approved the new dress code policy, and several deputies have already adopted the new look. This was from Lauren Pennington, the Denver Post. Two Colorado residents killed in small plane crash. Authorities are investigating the crash of a vintage biplane in northwest Kansas that killed two Colorado residents. The 1934 Waco YKC single-engine biplane crashed into a field around 10 miles north of Hoxie in Sheridan County around 6:10 p.m. Sunday, the Kansas Highway Patrol said. The patrol identified the pilot as David Allen, 78, of Elbert, and the passenger as Gene Allen, 79. They died at the scene. The Federal Aviation Administration and National Transportation Safety Board are in charge of the investigation. This brief was from the Associated Press. Former Tom's Diner. East Colfax building to become French-American restaurant. Champagne Tiger looks at September opening. By Caroline Leonard, Business Den. The one-time Tom's Diner building is taking a new form once again. Champagne Tiger, a soon-to-be French-American diner, has leased the building at 601 East Colfax Avenue in Denver that was home for 2 decades to Tom's Diner and then briefly Tom's Starlight. Owner Chris Donato said he's targeting a September opening for his restaurant that will feature specialty pasta and piano nights, as well as drag brunches on Sundays. Quote, "I've always been looking for a diner space. I wanted to create a French-American diner," end quote, Donato said. Quote, "And what that means to me is that you're sampling some of the classics from the land of the French brasier, but you're pairing it with American diner classics. And to make it better, having this high energy, or what we like to call bougie ratchet energy, that we really bring to the restaurants," end quote. The menu, he said, will range from burgers and omelets to caviar and oysters. He plans to be open 5 days a week for dinner and serve brunch on the weekend. Champagne Tiger has operated for about 3 years as a pop-up event company, hosting things such as drag brunches, bottomless champagne, and French fry nights at social clubs and restaurants in Denver. Now, Donato is transitioning all that to the East Colfax Diner. Quote, "We want to create a space focused on food and quality that's excellent because it is presented in a really joyous, celebratory atmosphere," end quote, he said. Quote, "What we're doing now is taking the energy of that pop-up series and presenting it as a full brick-and-mortar restaurant," end quote. Tom's Diner closed in 2020. Owner Tom Messina had planned to sell the property to a developer who would have demolished the structure. But when neighbors stepped up to try and save the structure, Messina struck an alternate deal, bringing on Cleveland-based GBX Group as a part owner of the real estate. In fall 2022, after the property was renovated, Messina opened Tom's Starlight, a pricier and less demanding bar and lounge. But he closed it last fall, after a year. Donato, who lives 2 blocks from the building, said he expressed interest in it before the end of last year. He's making few changes to the property because it was renovated so recently. The building is about 3,684 square feet with a bar and outdoor patio. Donato said he hopes to have a sizable private event business. The back patio, he said, can hold about 240 people. Donato previously worked for Frasca Hospitality Group, serving as head of operations and later brand manager for the Boulder-based chain Pizzeria Locale. The restaurant expanded with backing from Chipotle, only to see its 5 Denver locations shuttered last year. Donato said much of his background has focused on high-end or fine dining, but he wants Champagne Tiger to be accessible and a neighborhood diner where everyone is welcome. Reservations, he said, will be available with outdoor seating being first come, first served. Quote, "It's a neighborhood restaurant focused on creating moments of joy and celebration, whether that's through entertainment or through food or through beverage," end quote, Donato said. Quote, "We just want to celebrate it with everybody, whatever they've got going on," end quote. Brian Frank of Axio Commercial Real Estate represented the tenant in the deal. Ken Himmel and Sean Peel of David Hicks and Lampert Brokerage represented the landlord. Category 4 storm, Hurricane Beryl, raises Southeast Caribbean. By Danica Cotto and Kofi Jones, The Associated Press, Bridgetown, Barbados. Hurricane Beryl ripped off doors, windows, and roofs in homes across the southeastern Caribbean on Monday after making landfall on the island of Carriacou as the earliest storm of Category 4 strength to form in the Atlantic, fueled by record warm waters. There were no immediate reports of possible deaths or injuries, with communications largely down across the region. Streets from St. Lucia Island south to Grenada were strewn with shoes, trees, downed power lines, and scores of other debris scattered by winds up to 150 miles per hour, just shy of a Category 5 storm. The storm snapped banana trees in half and killed cows that lay in green pastures as if they were sleeping, with homes made of tin and plywood tilting precariously nearby. Quote, "Right now, I'm really heartbroken," end quote, said Vishal Clark King as she surveyed her damaged shop in the Barbadian capital of Bridgetown that was filled with sand and water. Beryl was still swiping the Southeast Caribbean late Monday afternoon, even as it began moving into the Caribbean Sea on a track that would take it just south of Jamaica and toward Mexico's Yucatan Peninsula by late Thursday as a Category 1 storm. Beryl was located about 125 miles northwest of Grenada and was moving west-northwest at 21 miles per hour, with hurricane conditions possible in Jamaica on Wednesday. A hurricane watch was in effect for Jamaica, and a tropical storm warning for Grenada, St. Lucia, Martinique, St. Vincent, and the Grenadines. The entire southern coast of Haiti and the southern coast of the Dominican Republic from Punta Planique westward to the border with Haiti. Quote, "Beryl is expected to remain an extremely dangerous major hurricane as it moves over the eastern Caribbean," end quote, the National Hurricane Center said. The last strong hurricane to hit the southwest Caribbean was Hurricane Ivan 20 years ago, which killed dozens of people in Grenada. NBC Radio in St. Vincent and the Grenadines said it received reports of roofs being torn off churches and schools as communications began collapsing across the southeast Caribbean. In nearby Grenada, officials received, quote, "reports of devastation," end quote, from Carriacou and surrounding islands, said Terrence Walters, Grenada's National Disaster Coordinator. Prime Minister Dickon Mitchell said he would travel to Carriacou as soon as it's safe, noting there's been an, quote, "extensive," end quote, storm surge. Grenada officials had to evacuate patients to a lower floor after a hospital roof was damaged, he said. Quote, "there is the likelihood of even greater damage," end quote, he told reporters. Quote, "we have no choice but to continue to pray," end quote. In Barbados, Wilfred Abrahams, Minister of Home Affairs and Information, said drones, which are faster than crews fanning across the island, would assess damage once Beryl passes. Forecasters had warned of a life-threatening storm surge of up to 9 feet in areas where Beryl made landfill, with 3 to 6 inches of rain for Barbados and nearby islands, and possibly 10 inches in some areas, especially in Grenada and the Grenadines. Beryl strengthened from a tropical depression to a major hurricane in just 42 hours, a feat accomplished only 6 other times in Atlantic hurricane history, and with September 1st as the earliest date, according to hurricane expert Sam Lillo. It also was the earliest Category 4 Atlantic hurricane on record, besting Hurricane Dennis, which became a Category 4 storm on July 8, 2005. Beryl amassed its strength from record warm waters that are hotter now than they would be at the peak of hurricane season in September, said hurricane specialist and storm surge expert Michael Lowry. Beryl also marked the farthest east that a hurricane has formed in the tropical Atlantic in June, breaking a record set in 1933, according to Philip Klotzbach, Colorado State University hurricane researcher. On Sunday night, Beryl formed a new eye, or center, something that usually weakens a storm slightly as it grows larger in area. Experts say it's now back to strengthening. Jaswitrapal Parmar of Fresno, California, who was among the thousands who traveled to Barbados for Saturday's 2020 World Cup cricket final, said he and his family were now stuck there with scores of other fans, their flights canceled on Sunday. He said by phone that it's the first time he has experienced a hurricane. He and his family have been praying, as well as taking calls from concerned friends and family as far away as India. Quote, "we couldn't sleep last night," end quote, Parmar, 47, said. Even as Beryl bore down on the southeast Caribbean, government officials warned about a cluster of thunderstorms mimicking the hurricane's path that have a 70% chance of becoming a tropical depression. Ukraine releasing inmates to battle Russia. Prisoners turned into fighters. By Vasilisa Stepanenko, Yevgeny Molotka, and Derek Gadopoulos. The Associated Press, Dnipro-Torovsk region, Ukraine. At a rural penal colony in southeast Ukraine, several convicts stand assembled under barbed wire to hear an army recruiter offer them a shot at parole. In return, they must join the grueling fight against Russia. Quote, "You can put an end to this and start a new life," end quote, said the recruiter, a member of a volunteer assault battalion. Quote, "The main thing is your will, because you are going to defend the motherland. You won't succeed at 50%. You have to give 100% of yourself, even 150%, end quote. Ukraine is expanding the draft to cope with acute battlefield shortages more than 2 years into fighting against Russia's full-scale invasion, and its recruiting efforts have turned for the first time to the country's prison population. Although Ukraine does not announce any details of troop deployment numbers or casualties, frontline commanders openly acknowledge that they are facing serious manpower problems as Russia continues to build up forces in eastern Ukraine and make incremental gains westward. More than 3,000 prisoners already have been released on parole and assigned to military units after such recruitment was approved by Parliament in a controversial mobilization bill last month. Ukrainian Deputy Justice Minister Yeleni Vysotska told the Associated Press, about 27,000 inmates could potentially be eligible for the new program, according to Justice Ministry estimates. Quote, "A lot of the motivation comes from inmates wanting to return home a hero and not to return home from prison," end quote, Vysotska said. Ernest Volvak, 27, wants to take up the offer. He's serving a 2-year sentence for robbery at the penal colony in Ukraine's Dnipropetrovsk region. He works in the kitchen, ladling dollops of food onto tin bowls. Quote, "It's stupid to sit here doing nothing," end quote, Volvach said, adding that since the start of the war, he's wanted to, quote, "do something for Ukraine," end quote, and have the opportunity to enlist. Quote, "Now it's appeared," end quote. Ukrainian soldiers on active duty are typically identified only by their first name or a call sign for security reasons. Many of the inmates at the Dnipropetrovsk penal colony also ask to be identified only by their first names to avoid difficulties if they enlist. Another inmate, 30, who gave his name only as Volodymyr, makes rivets at a penal colony workshop. He said he plans to volunteer after his sentence ends in 1 year, but wouldn't do so now because there's effectively no home leave under the parole program. Prisoners can get the conditional release after an interview, medical exam, and a review of their conviction. Those convicted of rape, sexual assault, murdering two or more people, or crimes against Ukraine's national security aren't eligible. Arapaho Basin, Altera's pending acquisition under scrutiny. Agency asked for data from ski areas across Rocky Mountain region by Bruce Finley, the Denver Post. Federal antitrust investigators are scrutinizing the Denver-based Altera Mountain Company's pending acquisition of Arapaho Basin, one of Colorado's last ski areas independent of corporate resort empires. Altera officials characterize it as a, quote, "customary," end quote, review that the U.S. Department of Justice requires for large transactions. The investigators have asked for business data on skiers at resorts across the Rocky Mountain region from the National Ski Areas Association. Department of Justice officials were mum, quote, "We will have no comment on any open investigation," end quote, federal spokeswoman Melissa Brandon said. The DOJ has demanded financial and visitation data that the NSAA and its market research partner, RRC Associates, collect from ski areas. Federal investigators sent a civil investigative demand, which is an administrative subpoena, and NSAA officials notified ski areas in a letter according to the Snowology website that first reported the demand. Quote, a filing with the DOJ was required, which is customary given the size of the transaction, end quote, according to a statement from Altera's chief legal officer, Karen Sanford. Quote, we are working through the process, end quote, the statement said, and, quote, we cannot otherwise comment on the status of the ongoing review with the DOJ, end quote. NSAA officials, too, have cast a scrutiny as a routine review and on Friday declined to comment. In the letter sent to ski areas last week, NSAA officials said DOJ investigators were looking into whether the proposed acquisition would stifle competition in the Rocky Mountain region. The letter said the feds were seeking survey data from 2023-2024 and the 2018-2019 ski season when Altera first introduced its Icon Pass. RRC officials did not respond. In February, Altera officials announced they were acquiring Arapaho Basin, which has been owned since 1997 by a Canadian real estate company. Federal justice officials often look into mergers and acquisitions. The ski industry has gone through consolidation, leading to corporations controlling much of the skiing landscape in Colorado. Altera owns the Steamboat Ski Resort and manages Winter Park for the city of Denver, among 17 resorts. Altera's rival, Vail Resorts, owns 5 resorts in Colorado: Vail, Beaver Creek, Keystone, Breckenridge, and Crested Butte, along with 36 others. These companies rely on sales of season passes. Vail Resorts sells Epic Passes, while Altera sells Icon Passes. In 1996, federal officials reviewing Vail's deal to acquire Keystone, Breckenridge, and Arapaho Basin forced Vail to sell Arapaho Basin to preserve adequate competition for Colorado Front Range residents to afford skiing. Home Builder, State AG Probes Pueblo Business, by Justin Wingerter, Business Den. IndieDwell Colorado, a manufacturer of modular homes, is being investigated to determine whether it defrauded taxpayers, according to recently unsealed court records. In March, the Colorado Attorney General's Office subpoenaed 8 computers and 4 tablets at the company's offices in Pueblo. When IndieDwell Colorado did not comply, the AG's office asked Denver District Court Judge Eric Eliff to enforce that subpoena on June 26. Quote, the property in question is material to an investigation under the Colorado False Claims Act, end quote. Eliff wrote in an order a few hours later, quote, and no impairment of business activities will result from the court granting the application without first hearing from IndieDwell Colorado, end quote. Quote, the court also finds that the state has carried its burden of showing that reasonable grounds exist for an order enforcing its subpoena on IndieDwell Colorado, end quote, he said. Created by the General Assembly in 2022, the Colorado False Claims Act added enforcement tools and enhanced the penalties for defrauding government programs. The law applies only to state and local government funding. A federal law is used in cases of federal dollars. Eliff's order was unsealed soon after he signed it, but other documents in the case, including the subpoena, will remain hidden from the press and public because they, quote, contain highly sensitive law enforcement information, end quote, according to the judge who has reviewed them. Assistant Attorney General Ben Gillig from the False Claims Unit is prosecuting the case, and fraud investigator Shelley Sartor is probing, court records show. An agency spokesman declined to say when its investigation began or what funding may have been misspent. IndieDwell, which did not respond to repeated emails and messages from Business Den, is based in Idaho and has 2 factories in California as well. IndieDwell Colorado has had financial and legal problems for years, as the Pueblo Chieftain has reported. The company received incentives from the Colorado Office of Economic Development and International Trade and the Pueblo Economic Development Corporation, along with grants from several nonprofits, to open a 100,000-square-foot manufacturing plant in 2019. That shut down in April 2023 and remains closed today. In May 2023, its top executives departed. Last summer, Habitat for Humanity of Archuleta County sued IndyDwell Colorado for not building three homes that it had paid $101,000 for. IndyDwell Colorado ignored the lawsuit, so a judge ordered IndyDwell Colorado to refund the money. It has paid only $8,000 to date. In March of this year, IndyDwell was similarly instructed to pay $38,000 after ignoring a lawsuit from a lumber supplier. 2 months later, it was ordered to pay $229,000 to the Colorado Enterprise Fund, which had loaned it money. Then, in May, it was sued by a building materials supplier in Colorado Springs, which claims it is owed $95,000. That case is ongoing. On June 26th, just 2 hours before Judge Eliff's order, IndyDwell Colorado filed paperwork with the Colorado Secretary of State's office dissolving the company. The lawyer who filed it, Melanie Bartlett, at Fairfield and Woods in Denver, didn't return calls for comment. Thank you for joining us for the Denver Post, read by Diane Adler.
If you enjoyed this program, please register for our free services at www.aftersight.org or by calling 303-786-7777.